We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Jacques Monod was a director of the Pasteur Institute of Paris, a biochemist who won his Nobel Prize for cellular biochemistry. He, in 1970, wrote a book called Chance and Necessity. He picked the title, Chance and Necessity, from part of a quotation of Democritus, the 5th century BC Greek philosopher. Democritus was the man who was for atomism, the man who saw that the whole universe was a materialistic universe and that it was composed of atoms, that is, the smallest possible unit, the indivisible. We, of course, in the 20th century, think nothing of having divided the atom, but Democritus, as he coined and utilized the words of atoms, did so as that which is the smallest possible unit, and from that combined together, the whole universe exists, and there is nothing else in this universe but the atoms. Democritus' quote that Monod referred to is, "Everything existing in the universe is the fruit of chance and necessity." And from these materialistic assumptions, Monod was able to reach the materialistic conclusion that life is an accident. It's not hard, actually, if you start off with that set of assumptions. That life equals nothing more than matter plus time plus chance. That given the eternal existence of the material universe, or the matter of the universe, and given enough time, and given enough opportunistic chances, accidents, then the world and the universe and everything we can know of it will frame and shape itself into what we have today. So life is matter plus time plus chance. However, Monod finished off his book with a chapter on the ethics, the morality. It's a very good book to read if you want to understand basic 1970s understanding of DNA and of cells and of the universe. It was written as a popularist book. It was written to make the discoveries of the mid-century understandable to the person in the street who knows no biochemistry. It's a useful, but when you reach this last chapter, you suddenly have a chapter on ethics. That though the whole of life is nothing but matter, time plus chance, yet we humans ought, must, should react and behave in certain fashions. The ethical system that he wishes to establish is the ethics of knowledge, that knowledge itself creates an ethics. And when you read the last chapter, generally most people have come to the conclusion that Monod should have stuck to biochemistry. Because he makes the age-old problem that all ethics has of the jump from the is to the ought. Because something is, therefore it is. That is all you can say. Because this glass of water is there, because there is this glass of water, therefore I nothing. Therefore there is a cup of water there. That is it. It doesn't tell me what I should be doing or shouldn't be doing, could be doing or couldn't be doing. It's just saying there is a glass of water there. Once you establish what is, you've established what is. You haven't even started to say what ought to happen. The jump from the is to the ought is the great problem for all those who want to have something of a materialistic, accidentalist view of the universe, such as Monod, or such as Democritus. It's the problem of naturalistic objectivist moralities generally. for how to move from what is to what ought, especially if what is nothing more than chance and necessity. You see, we're here because it's just an infinite regression from there on in. I think I can save you the time. You'll get the general drift as to where we're heading. There is nothing more that can be said if we are just a matter plus time plus chance. We're here because we're here, because we're here, because we're here, because we're here. That is it. There is nothing more to it than that. And yet, Monod, with many others, want to have something more than that, want to have some reason, some meaning, some understanding, some moral objectives that could be there. Something more than, I'm here because I'm here, and therefore I'm going to do what I want to do. Well, the therefore doesn't follow that I'm here because I'm here, and what I'm going to do is determined by nothing more than what I want to do. It's not any basis of what I ought to do, let alone what you ought to do, or all humanity ought to do, or anything of a morality. Objects in and of themselves have no meaning. Their meaning is given to them by their manufacturer, or their owner, or their judge. Here is an object. What does it mean? Well, it doesn't mean anything. Well, what is its purpose? Well, it has no purpose. It just is an object. That's all it is. You say, no, Philip, you know, you're not a highly technical man. You don't understand. The purpose of that is to wipe chalk off boards. You can even come and demonstrate to me. I say, no, it doesn't have that purpose. The manufacturer made it for that reason. The university who owns it for that reason. You who are utilising it are utilising it for that reason. And we can all sit back and watch it operate and then say it's good at doing it or it's bad at doing it. So in your judgment of it, you can give it that reason. But it itself is just itself. It's just an object. The object has no meaning. The manufacturer, owner or judge gives it meaning. That is why some atheists rightly complain about Christians when we talk about the meaning of life. They say to talk about the meaning of life, let alone ask people what is the meaning of life, assumes that Christianity is correct. Because it assumes that life has a meaning. Even to ask what is the meaning of life assumes that it could be. Whereas if life is matter plus time plus chance, then by definition it doesn't have a meaning. It is chance. It has always been. It just is. And the very question of what is the meaning of life is a nonsense question. It's a meaningless question because life doesn't have any meaning. The question is assuming more than matter, time and chance. Objects only have the meaning given to them from outside, from a conscious mind. The meaning is the activity of a thinking person. I can give to this object a meaning, but that's not that the object has the meaning. I can give it the meaning that I wish to give it, but it does not carry its own meaning. But of course, if every person starts to make up their own meanings, then we're not saying there is a meaning to life, we're just saying there are lots of people who give life meanings. And there is no way of contesting why one meaning is more meaningful or less meaningful than any other meaning. It's just an expression of yourself. When you say, I think the meaning of life is X, you're not telling us anything about life, you're just telling us something about you and what you think the meaning of, because it doesn't have a meaning. You are giving it meaning. Now, the only way, therefore, to break beyond this total relativism is to actually see the meaning of somebody who is in position to give to it meaning, such as the owner or the maker or the judge of something. But once you start using that language of humans, then you are treating humans as objects of manufacture. And that is to reduce humans to being not self-governing persons, but objects made, owned, and judged by somebody else. It is insulting. Too insulting for most people to swallow. to perceive ourselves as objects whose meaning comes from not ourselves, but from somebody else who is giving us meaning. Who are they to give me meaning? The answer, your maker. Well, who is it that is my maker? And what right has he got to make me? And what makes you think I am made? We come to the last of our series in Ecclesiastes, chapters 10 to 12. And chapters 11 and 12 conclude the argument. Chapter 10 is a continuation of the argument we've had so far, and its comments are not all that much different or an advance on chapters 1 to 9, so I'll be skipping on chapter 10 fairly quickly in order to move to the concluding arguments of chapters 11 and 12. But in chapter 10, you'll find there are good rulers and bad rulers. We do not need to limit this to kings and monarchs. It's true of prime ministers and presidents and premiers. And we don't even have to take it to the state. It's true of vice chancellors and bosses and club presidents and unit strata managers and anybody who's in authority anywhere, especially the most authoritarian of all people, the people who wear dust jackets and carry walkie-talkies inside parking lots. Whoever it may be, there are good ones and bad ones. And there are benefits living with wise ones, just as there are problems living with foolish ones. Pick it up in chapter 10, verse 16. 10:16. Woe to you, O land, whose king was a servant and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth and whose princes eat at a proper time and strength for strength and not for drunkenness. If a man's lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter. Wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything. Do not revile the king even in your thoughts or curse the rich man in your bedroom, because a bird of the air may carry your words and a bird on the wing may report what you say. You see, in verse 17, there are benefits in having a wise king whose own household is in order, whose children eat for the sake of eating and not for the sake of their own degeneracy, whereas the foolish king, with his sons who are drunk in the morning, the foolish king is the kind of one whose laziness will lead to the rafters sagging, whose idleness will lead to a leaky house. But the wisdom and folly is not confined to the rulers. It's actually about the way of responding to the rulers. There is a wise way to respond to rulers and a foolish way. The wise way you'll see in, say, chapter 10, verse 4. If a ruler's anger rises against you, do not leave your post. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. So the boss is really cranky with you and drawing tripe out of you, just stay calm, do your job, keep your head down. Your composure at that point will calm down the situation, will enable it to get to chapter 10, verse 12. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but a fool is consumed by his own lips. See, a gentle answer turns aside wrath. Speak quietly, speak graciously, and you'll see the situation change. Or chapter 10, verse 20, don't revile the king. Even when you're in private, don't be speaking out against him, because walls have ears, because you'll be overheard, because you can't keep your private conversations private. That is a folly. Do not do it. There's a famous occasion of a High Court judge of Australia who was speaking to one of his friends, who was the Mr. Big of crime in Sydney. The fact that those two should be friends was a problem enough itself. They were speaking on the phone about corrupting a politician in the New South Wales government, and the High Court judge had the wit and wisdom to say on the telephone to his criminal friend, "Hey, you better keep quiet. You never know who's listening on the telephone." At that time, the New South Wales police were listening on the telephone and were taping it all, unfortunately illegally, so that when the tapes were submitted to court, they were ruled as inadmissible evidence. Such is the nature of it. You never know who's listening. So you needn't even say to people, "Hey, shh, somebody might be listening," because they might. The fool will talk a lot. Verses 12 to 15, it's the character of fools. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the fool is consumed by his own lips. At the beginning of his words are folly, at the end a wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. No one knows what's coming. Who can tell him what will happen after him? A fool's work wearies him. He doesn't know the way to town. Doesn't know the way to town, it's just a proverbial thing. You know, couldn't find his way out of a paper bag, finds going up an escalator heavy weather. It's that kind of way of saying that The man doesn't know what he's talking about, he doesn't know what he's doing, he doesn't know which way is which, he doesn't know which way is up or which way is down, but he never shuts up, he keeps on talking. And that's a problem for those of us who've got verbal diarrhea, of which I've shared for many years, that you've got to be careful that just because you speak a lot doesn't mean you think at all, because most of us are able to do both things at the same time, that is, not think and speak. The fool will talk a lot. The wise man will speak graciously and carefully. But don't underestimate foolishness. It has disproportionate power, chapter 10, verse 1. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so a little folly outweighs wisdom and honour. It is very powerful, a little folly. Words that are taken without meaning and without understanding and given like that have led people into terrible errors. And foolishness has a perversity in its ways, verses 2 and 3. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. When I remember first reading that passage some many years ago, I immediately, in verse 2, thought of my friend John Chapman, who has always voted for the Labour Party on the left-hand side of politics. And so I rang him up to tell him that Ecclesiastes 10:2 was descriptive of his politics. He was not amused. Well, he was. If you know Chapo, he would be amused. And what is it about? Left is often seen as evil. I'm sorry if you're left-handed. I don't mean to be rude to you, and I'm sorry for you because you've got all those disadvantages of life already, being left-handed, but... My left-handed daughter is running a world campaign. If you want to join her, she says the whole world is handist and is seeking to rectify this. She wouldn't put it right because that's also handist, isn't it? So she's putting it left. And it's the word sinister, you see, is left. That could be what is being meant here, but more likely is the fool is perverse. Everyone goes to the right, so he'll go to the left. You know, he'll do things just out of sheer cussedness, out of perverseness. And as he walks along the road, in the end, everybody works out that he's a fool. You can fool some of the people some of the time, and you can fool all the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time, which is variously ascribed to two most unlikely characters in some ways, to Abraham Lincoln and to Barnum of the circus fund. And the old phrase could come from either of them if you think about it. The fool will be seen for what he is, a fool. And our community is like that. It keeps making decisions out of foolishness. And foolishness lacks forethought. So verses 8 to 11, whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them if the axe is dull. See, the fool doesn't prepare ahead, doesn't look ahead as to what's going to happen. He just makes changes and then suffers their own consequences of them. I think of this in terms of the civil libertarians and our censorship arguments. Their perversity is profound at times. You see, in the 1960s we had a fair degree of censorship, and the argument came that we should release and relax all this censorship because we've got to be a free society. A free society will only have true freedom when truth can be spoken. Truth can't be spoken in a society where censorship occurs. And for the sake of political censorship, as the argument went, so all kinds of barriers of censorship had to come down. Now, so far I'm in agreement with them. But the trouble was, they couldn't pick garbage when they sat in a garbage dump. There is garbage, there is such a thing as garbage, and you can actually smell it and see it if you've got any slight sensitivity. But their views of censorship were such that they wanted anything and everything to be free. Well, now anything and everything is free. And you'll notice it comes out of the Capital Territory in particular, where our civil libertarians live in the greatest numbers and vote in ways completely contrary to the rest of the nation, because after all we pay for their existence. And they are the people who are now producing the X-rated movies that is sold all over the countryside, and they cannot pick garbage for garbage. In fact, they appointed a porn movie man as one of the censors of Australia, which is really sensible if you want to make sure that pornography just increases. They just can't see garbage for garbage. They can't look at something and say, that is degenerate, throw it away. The end consequence of it is twofold. One, we still have any amount of political censorship in Australia. The laws against defamation are so massive that it's very hard to say anything true about politicians or about leaders or about the people whom we need to hear the truth. while at the same time our whole community is deluged in garbage. In fact, one of the chief people who broke through on the censorship scheme in the 1960s, when his teenage children in the 1990s started to go and see some of this foul garbage, he complained bitterly. It occurred to me then this kind of passage is in mind. You open up the whole world and then complain what you see. You should have had more forethought in the first place. Well, chapter 10 doesn't seem to advance us very far. We know from chapters 1 to 9 and now 1 to 10, wisdom is superior to folly because of the outcomes of actions. But wisdom doesn't know the outcome of all actions. For we live in a world of time and chance. We live in a world under irrational rulers. We live in circumstances that are beyond our control. We live in a world in which only death is our sure future. And death makes nothing of us or of anything we've ever tried to do. So how now should we live? Chapter 7, he plays with the idea of don't do too much. Don't be overwise, don't be over righteous, don't be over evil, don't be over foolish. Just kind of the middle ground of nothingness. Just go with the flow. Just kind of let life take you along. In chapters 2, chapter 5, chapter 8, chapter 9, he takes the line of enjoy life while you have it. We know death is worse than anything else because then you don't have anything. So while you've got life, enjoy it. Take action. Now we come to this final wind-up of the book in the last two chapters, and here the answer commences with that idea of taking action. In chapter 11, verses 1 to 6. Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. If clouds are full of water, they pour rain upon the earth. Whether a tree falls to the south or to the north, in the place where it falls, there it'll lie. Whoever watches the wind will not plant, whoever looks at the cloud will not reap. As you do not know the path of the wind or how the body is formed in a mother's womb, so you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things. Sow your seed in the morning, and at the evening let not your hands be idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. See, you don't know the outcome, you don't know the result. But we live in a world where there are any number of givens. The rain comes. Boy, has it come this last week, hasn't it? The rain comes, the rain comes. The rain goes away, the rain goes away. The tree falls there, well, there it falls. Now, I can stand paralysed by my ignorance about things, or I can accept the reality of these things and get on with life. I can stand there saying in the road all the time, saying, I can't go forward, there's a tree across the road, there's a tree across the road, I can't go forward, or I can step over the tree and keep going because trees fall across roads. I can say, well, look, it looks like it's going to rain, I'll stay at home. Or I can say, well, I don't know if it's going to rain or not, so I'll go out. Which is the option to go? Cast your bread on the waters. Take a punt. Have a go. That is what is being said here in this passage. You cannot know the outcome, so therefore, get stuck into it, doing it. Do what you want. If you do nothing, you're bound to receive nothing. He who aims at nothing is assured of success. And so, we should try and do something. I mean, our proverbial wisdom has the same kind of dilemmas, doesn't it? On one hand, you can have fools rush in, where angels fear to tread, and on the other hand, you have he who hesitates is lost. Or we can have look before you leap, or a stitch in time saves nine. You don't know what to do. Does that mean you should race in, or does that mean you should hold back? Well, there's a time to hold back and look, and there is a time to leap. But in the end, the wise must leap. You cannot forever sit on the fence dangling your feet over the edge. Life is for living. It's not for contemplating, it's for living. It's not for photographing, it's for living. Ultimately, you cannot even contemplate life without experiencing it. See, there are some people who go to parties and party. There are some people who go to parties and photograph everybody else partying. Parties are not for photography. Parties are for living. Go and live. Take the plunge. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. It's the fact that we cannot know the outcome that transfixes some of us into inactivity. I don't know if she'll say yes, so I will not ask her. Or I do not know if I'll be able to do that job, so I won't apply for it. But it is equally possible to argue the exact opposite. I don't know if she'll say yes, So I may as well ask her and find out. I don't know if I'll be able to do that job. So I may as well apply and find out. For rest assured, if I don't ask, she won't say yes. If I don't apply, I won't get the job. Well, I may as well then have a go. I would just say, shouldn't I do some research first? Shouldn't I read? Shouldn't I think? Shouldn't I search out what may be the case? Let me do a little research. Let me read a paper or a book or two on the subject, and then I'll know that my chances are better, and I'll be able to decide and act. Well, go to the end of Ecclesiastes, to the famous favourite verse of all students, chapter 12, verse 12. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them, that is the words that are before us. Of making many books there is no end, and much study wearies the body. How much research? How many books? How much study before you'll be able to live? See, I talked to a bookworm friend of mine when he turned 50. He was the kind of man who reads a book a night. He was telling me he reads about 5 books every week. But when he turned 50, he moved into something of a bit of a downer and a depression. And so I rang and talked to him to cheer him up, and I said, what's your problem? And he said, well, I've just worked out that I only have 15 years of working life left. And I said, yes, well, that's generally the case when you're 50. And he said, yes, but that means I only have time to read another 3,900 books. I thought it was all 3,900 is not bad. I went, 4,000 would be better, but 3,900, that's not bad. And he said, yes, but that's out of all the millions of books that are available. He said, you walk into a library, which of the 3,900 will I read? Because there are so many books out there, and I have such limited time now, I don't want to read anything that's not worth reading. I don't want to waste one of my 4,000 volumes on something that is stupid. And yet how do I go about spending the next 15 years reading creatively and properly when there are millions and millions of books to read, and I am now caught all the time in choosing not to read books. Every time I take one down from the shelf, there are all those other ones that I am now choosing not to read. I'm leaving on the shelf. So I just don't have time to read the library anymore. What percentage of the books you read do you ever remember anyway? How many books do you read that you can say, ah, that's changed my whole thought. Now I think differently about the world. Now I'm going to live differently. Now I can see my wife, my children, my jobs, my country, I can see the grass is greener and the sky is bluer. Now my life is in chance. Now I can actually make wise decisions because I've read that book. And I remember what it says. How many books are like that? Churning through thousands and thousands and leaving behind millions. See, our civilization is like a motorist reading a road map with a car gently rolling over a cliff. You see, life hasn't got the handbrake on. It is moving. It is going. Time is passing. You can sit and say, well, I've got to get the road map right. I've got to understand where I'm going. But you are going already. There is no kind of break point which you can stop and say, okay, I'm not going to do anything now until I've read everything, and then I'll make good decisions. By the time you've read everything, you're well and truly dead. And then what the decision? Well, it doesn't matter what decision. You never made it. When the Sydney Cricket Ground crowd sees a batsman lose his nerve, getting bogged down and unable to score runs, they know that he is facing certain defeat. Because the essence of the game of cricket is to score more runs than your opposition, and if you're not scoring runs, then you cannot win. But more than that, once you stop scoring runs, it's only a matter of time and you'll be out. To score runs in cricket always requires risk. Every shot that's going to bring runs is a shot that's risky. Every shot that just pads the ball away is less risky. And so when you lose your nerve, you just go into your shell and don't score runs. You just bat away each ball, bat away each ball. But that is a recipe for imminent wicket taking. And so when the crowd at the Sydney Cricket Ground sees the batsman lose his nerve and get bogged down, unable to score runs, they cry out, have a go, you mug. Because you've got to have a go in order to be able to do anything in cricket. And they call him a mug because that's what he is. You see, inactivity is ultimately foolishness. Inactivity cannot win in the game of life. You cannot win the game and preserve your wicket by doing nothing. See, the only business people who take no risks are the business people who are bankrupt or public servants. They create no wealth, they spend their time on committees, and they assure themselves of the best seats on the fence. So with the commencement of chapter 11 and to the end of chapter 12, the finale of Ecclesiastes is taken, and it's about take action. Cast your bread on the waters, for only then will you get some return back again. But when? What action should I take, and when should I do it? Well, here is an old poem from Robert Herrick. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying. When do you gather your rosebuds? Well, before they're dead. That's when. When you're still alive, when you have the opportunity, when you have the charm. In fact, particularly when you're young. Chapter 11, verse 7. Light is sweet and it pleases the eyes to see the sun. How many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless. Be happy, young man, while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see, but know that for all these things God will bring you to judgment. So then banish anxiety from your heart and cast off the trouble of your body, for youth and vigour are meaningless. Enjoy life. Enjoy it while you have it, before death comes. A light is sweet, so enjoy its sweetness, because once death comes you move into darkness and there is no light there. Enjoy its sweetness, because once death comes you move into darkness and there is no light there to enjoy. So as long as the light's on, enjoy the light. In particular, when you are young, young enough to enjoy it. For youth is the time of merrymaking and fun and pleasure and love and laughter. You know, Proverbs 20 says, glory of the young man is his strength. While you still have your strength, glory in it. Enjoy the carefree days of youth. In the games and the sports that you are still able to play, that you still have the muscles, you still have the eye-hand coordination, you still have the eyesight, that you can see the ball, that you still have the timing, while your body is able to enjoy the bodily experiences, enjoy them. Enjoy them to the full. In the 1960s and 70s, there was a drinking song that was made popular with the baby boomers. Those were the days, my friend. I thought they'd never end. When you're in youth, it feels like that. No one is more immortal than a 20-year-old Australian driving a motor car. There is that sense that it will never end. The power of the right foot pushed firmly to the metal. It is an enormous sense of exhilaration. And there is a more sober and yet at the same time fun student song from the 13th century, Gaudiamus Igitur, which is often sung in Latin to make sure no one knows what it means. By translation it says, let us live then and be glad while young life before us. While we have it, enjoy it. That is what is being said in this song. That is what is being said here in Ecclesiastes. This is now your age. It's the time to enjoy life to the full. Fill your hearts with pleasure. This is why the baby boomers are always talking about the 60s. That's because they were young then. That was their age, their decade, their moment, their time, when they had life itself. They haven't had it since, but they've had it then. And that is why they keep harping on about it, because that's when they were alive for that brief moment of time. And that is your time now. So make sure you enjoy it to the full. But notice the reason why he's saying to do so now. Because the days of trouble are coming, when you will not be able to. When the hair will grey and the girth will widen, The eye will slow, and the increase of responsibilities and worries and chores and taxes and children and mortgage will take away from you any of the joys of life. Let us live then and be glad while young life before us, after youthful pastimes had, after old age hard and sad. Earth will slumber o'er us. Just straight out of Ecclesiastes, really, isn't it? And that's what's going to happen in the future. You know that's what's going to happen in the future. You've got a little window of opportunity called youth. Go for it while you've got it. Take hold of it and enjoy it to the full. See, people don't expect the Bible to be saying that, do they? Which shows how perverted their minds are, because the Bible says it. You're then given in chapter 12, verses 1 to 8, one of the greatest poems of the Bible. Some of the details are hard to be precise about, but poetry is evocative. You don't have to worry about the details. Feel the weight of what is being said. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. Before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars grow dark and the clouds return after the rain. When the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. When the grinders cease because they are few and those looking through the windows grow dim. When the doors to the street are closed and the sound of the grinding fades. When men rise up at the sound of birds but all their songs grow faint. When men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the street. When the almond tree blossoms and the grasshopper drags himself along and desire no longer is stirred. Then men goes to his eternal home. And mourners go about the streets. Remember him before the silver cord is severed and the golden bowl is broken, when the pitcher is shattered at the spring or the wheel broken at the well and the dust returns to the ground it came from and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. It's where he started back in chapter 1. It's where he seems he winds up at the end of chapter 12. Like I say, silver cord, golden bowl, you can't actually get precision as to what these phrases might mean, but the overall is devastatingly clear. The effect of age and death coming upon us. When keepers tremble. When the strong stoop. When you become old and you get afraid of heights and afraid of the streets. Or that lovely image at springtime when the grasshopper drags himself along and desire has gone. Look ahead, friends, at what life holds. Look at the old people and their disabilities. Look into the convalescent hospitals or homes from which no one ever convalesces. Look at tomorrow. Look at your parents. Look at your grandparents. Look at your great-grandparents. You say they're dead. I'm saying exactly, look at them. For that is your tomorrow. Look and know that you will be there one day, all too soon. I am old enough that I didn't do the HSC, I did the leaving certificate. And in my leaving certificate, in the English textbook, we were set a novel to read, which I would encourage everybody not to read. In fact, I've never met anybody who's read this novel except for the fact that they were set it for an examination. It's a novel called The Old Wives' Tale, written by Arnold Bennett. Anybody here read it for pleasure? No, I didn't think there were any sick minds here. Anybody else read it? You can pick the year we went to school, same year as me. I've never met anybody who's ever read it other than the people who read it for the leaving certificate that year. Arnold Bennett got the idea of The Old Wives' Tale from going to a cafe where he saw a couple of very young women full of fun and enjoyment and life and a couple of very old, stout, elderly women looking very tired and worn out. And he noticed that the young women kept on giggling at the old women. And he thought, those young women are one day going to be those old women. Why can't they see it? Why do they laugh? He said, it's because age comes on you in, quote, an infinite number of infinitesimal changes, infinitesimal and unperceived, that bit by bit, over a long period of time, they are going to turn into those, and they never see that it is happening because it happens so slowly, so small are the changes. And so he set out to write a novel where you would start with lovely young women who would wind up to be fat, old, stodgy women, but the change would happen so slowly you wouldn't notice it. It goes for hundreds and hundreds of turgid pages describing infinitesimal changes. Nothing actually ever happens in the novel. Nothing. Except at the end of the novel, the heroines are the exact reverse of what they were at the beginning of the novel. Why you would set 16-year-old males to read that in the hope of encouraging them into a life of English literature, I do not know, but it was the New South Wales Department of Education. Can I encourage you? Don't bother with the book. You've got the point already in my few minutes of explanation. And yet his point is the point of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? While you are young, look to where you're going and enjoy what you've got while you've got it. And as you live, enjoy your youth. Remember all this sadness, before all this sadness overwhelms you, remember your Creator and know something. Know that for all these things of your youth, chapter 11, verse 9, God will bring you to judgment. Anxieties and troubles you can cast off, but youth and vigour are in the long run meaningless. To be young is not meaningful because in the end you won't be young. There's no meaningfulness in being young. You enjoy life while you are young, but in your enjoyment of life, remember, God will bring you into judgment for the things that you are doing. It is the failure of our society that worships youth, that enjoys mutton dressed up as lamb, that fails to ever face and discuss death, that glories in the past when we were young, that glories in the sporting prowess of our present youth generation. These things are only games, friends, and you must remember they are only games. In the end, who cares who wins the grand final? You say, which grand final? And I say, exactly. It doesn't matter, does it? Which grand final of which competition in which sport is a complete and utter meaningless irrelevance. Who cares who wins it? Enjoy it while you play it. But forget about it afterwards. It's not the meaning of life. It's not the purpose of our existence. It's just one of those enjoyable things that you can do when you're young enough to play the game. But in the end, the game is only a game. There are those people, you see, who spend their time learning all the statistics of cricket out of that fabulous series of books called Wisdom, as if the statistics of cricket players down the centuries is somehow significant and meaningful, that my mind should be cluttered up with all the information of how many runs were scored on a wet afternoon in Yorkshire in 1932, as if it somehow matters. But it's only a game. It's only the backyard on Christmas Day, written big and televised for the world. It's, in the end, just a backyard game for people to entertain themselves with and to work off too much dinner. And so, in your youth, as you enjoy life and the games of life, remember. Remember, verse 1, your Creator, chapter 12. Chapter 12, verse 6, remember him, remember your Creator. That is what Campus Bible Study is doing. Here is an opportunity to congratulate the crowd. Here is the opportunity not to rebuke the crowd, but to say nice things about the crowd. You see, you've done the right thing. In the midst of a busy life, in the midst of a busy youth, you've taken time off to come and think about big issues, to come and read about God and what he has to say, to remember your Creator. Well done. For there are lots of other things you can do during a lunchtime, aren't they? And there's lots of even fun, enjoyable things that you can do during a lunchtime here, as well as things that seem to be meaningful, like going up into the library and getting out Wisdom and learning the statistics of the cricket history. There are things, but you have, in the midst of the busyness and the enjoyments of life, taken time out to remember him. Well done, keep doing it. The author then draws stumps with his conclusion. Verse 8 following, 9 following. Not only was the teacher wise, but also he imparted knowledge for the people. He pondered and searched out and set in order many proverbs. The teacher searched to find just the right words, and what he wrote was upright and true. The words of the wise are like goads, their collected sayings like firmly embedded nails given by one shepherd. Be warned, my son, of anything in addition to them. Of making many books there's no end, and much study wearies the body. Now all has been heard. Here is the conclusion of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man, for God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Here is the conclusion of the author. He steps out from behind the curtain and speaks at last for himself, no longer in the mouthpiece of the teacher. And he draws his conclusion in a twofold fashion in verses 13 and 14. One, fear God. Two, judgment. And they're causally connected. Fearing God is the beginning of wisdom. Fearing God means doing his commandments. Fearing God is the whole duty of man. It is the Creator that the youth must remember. We didn't make ourselves, and we are not just an accident of time and chance. We are manufactured by the God of all this world. And if he made us, we should remember him. We should know him. We should fear him. We should keep his commandments. Because, secondly, God is going to bring all our actions into judgment, including our secrets, the motivations of our heart. Here at last is the meaning of it all. Here at last we find values that are absolute, not relative. Here is where virtues and vices will be seen in the judgment of our Creator, owner, and judge. I may not like being created, manufactured. I may not like being owned by somebody else, and I certainly don't like being judged by somebody else. And yet, it is in my creation, in the fact that I am owned, and in the fact that I am judged, that my life is meaningful. And so we finish our series in Ecclesiastes, but you cannot finish it without bringing you its final message. Take action. Life under the sun is meaningless. Our contemporaries know that. The theatre of the absurd, the existentialist philosophers, the post-modernity, death keeps assuring us of our meaninglessness. But while we're still young, while we have the opportunity, before the grind of middle age weighs us down, or before the disintegration of the senior years slows you down, or before the grave takes you down, enjoy life. Don't stick on the edge of the pool. Jump into the water. It's fine. Live life as much as you can to be enjoyed. But remember, the enjoyment of life is not the meaning of life. Remember your Creator as you enjoy life that he has given you. Remember him while you still may remember anything. And don't be seduced into the enjoyments of youth as if they are the meaning of life. They're all meaningless too. And our owner and our judge. So fear him and do as he commands, for this is the whole duty of man. We come next week to meet our Maker when we turn to John's Gospel. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your Son. We thank you for the youth that you have given to us and the life and the energy and the enjoyments. And we pray that you would help us to enjoy life as we should, and in the enjoyments of our youth and our life, to remember you and to remember your judgments, that we might live as you would have us to live, and so that we might find and experience the full meaning of the life that you have given to us. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.